Support your curiosity by becoming a member of KCRW. That way you can help ensure KCRW music, news, and culture will continue to thrive and fulfill your need to know. Donate at kcrw.com/join.
Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
Well, and only back with Which Way L.A. Even by aerospace standards, the numbers are stunning. 100 new stealth bombers to be built in the Antelope Valley. Thousands of new jobs. All paid for with $60 billion federal dollars, with production cost overruns likely to push that much higher. That's the economic windfall from one of the biggest contracts in Pentagon history, won yesterday by Northrop Grumman after long competition with Boeing and Lockheed. William Hennigan reports from the Pentagon for the L.A. Times. Hi, William. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this new plane. What will it look like? How high will it fly?
Well, all that is kept quite under wraps as for now. We don't really have any idea of the way it'll look. The odds are that it'll look a lot like the B-2 because it's a stealthy platform and the sort of materials involved. But yeah, it looks like it's coming to Palmdale.
Tell us about the economics.
So as it stands, Northrop Grumman has a huge facility out in Palmdale where it built the B-2 stealth bomber. Northrop has not decided, or at least hasn't announced, where it's going to build the aircraft, but it looks they've told city leadership there that they're likely to build it there. The bigger picture is that the suppliers out throughout Southern California, parts suppliers, guys who make fasteners and other widgets on the aircraft, they stand to have a windfall of work off a big program like this.
So these are the subcontractors.
That's correct.
And if it's not built there, would there still be a big economic impact?
Yeah, whether or not it's built in Palmdale, it does not matter. I mean, the aerospace subcontracting base in Southern California is there's no places like it in the country that have the sort of certification, the qualification, and the industrial power to be able to crank out these fine parts.
If it weren't finally assembled in Palmdale, where would that happen?
Well, Northrop has plants all over the country. There has been rumor that perhaps it might be in Florida, but again, state lawmakers have $500 million in tax credits that they've given Northrop already if they decide to build large parts of the aircraft in Palmdale, and they have such big facilities that are that have been there since the 80s to be able to have this sort of capability to crank out aircraft like this.
So those are California legislators, obviously, that have made those offers.
That's right.
Yeah. William Hennigan, once again, with the LA Times in Washington. Robert Kleinhans is the chief economist for the Los Angeles County Economic Development Corporation. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks very much.
Is this a return to the good old days of the aerospace industry in Southern California?
Well, the aerospace ecosystem, if you want to call it that, has really changed over the last few decades. We don't have the same job counts that we had 25 years ago. I think that's pretty well known. Significantly declining job counts relative to back then. But job counts have stabilized here in Los Angeles County for the last few years. And we are looking at a different industry. We're still seeing fixed-wing craft and parts being made here, not so much assembly, helicopters, but now satellites and drones and cybersecurity and the commercialization of space. So the industry is here. As Bill pointed out, it has a critical mass here in Los Angeles County, but it certainly has changed over the last few decades.
Does that mean then that it won't have as much of a ripple effect as it might have in the past, this one contract?
Well, if you look at the numbers, the numbers that I have seen suggest that there may be 1,100 direct jobs associated with this program. It's not clear over what time span, but when you stack that up against a job base for the entire county of over 4 million wage and salary jobs, it doesn't sound like it's all that large. But keep in mind that these are jobs in the aerospace industry, they involve engineers, scientists, as well as factory workers who typically are paid well above the norm for manufacturing, even here in Los Angeles County. And so may not necessarily be a large number of jobs, but the impact on the rest of the economy should be fairly substantial.
William Hennigan, back to you at the LA Times at the Pentagon. How long does it appear this might take, this contract?
This is going to be about 10 years. Then after that, you start getting into production. So this could go on for another 10 to 20 years. And then even after that, the planes that have been flying have to come back for maintenance. So I'll give you, for instance, the U-2 was first built in 1955. It's still flying into Palmdale for routine maintenance today.
If, in fact, it were assembled somewhere else, would it still be coming back to Palmdale for maintenance?
Well, again, none of these decisions just simply haven't been made yet. But yeah, I mean, the idea is to keep this thing humming. I mean, Northrop has an incentive to want it to go as long as it can.
And so do the people in Palmdale who are celebrating this event, this contract, in a big way.
That's for sure. I mean, The aerospace industry in Southern California has gone through a huge cutback over the years in the end of the Cold War. A program like this comes by once in a generation. So there's a lot to look forward to in a program like this.
Let me introduce Gordon Adams. He was a senior White House budget official for national security during the Clinton administration. He's a longtime budget watcher in Washington, D.C. He's now a regular columnist for Foreign Policy magazine as well. Gordon Adams, good to have you back on our program.
Nice to be on the program.
What does it appear this plane is for?
Well, the plane has a multiplicity of missions. So what happens over time is as we have fewer and fewer different types of aircraft, we start loading missions onto the ones we have. So this one's supposed to be designed for long-range strike, meaning it's got to fly a long distance and strike the Earth. It can be used short-range, shorter range with conventional weapons. It can be used for strategic nuclear bombing. And the Air Force is suggesting it might even have surveillance and reconnaissance missions that they build into it eventually.
Can you do all that with one plane?
You can do all that with one plane, Warren, but the reality is when you start adding stockpiling missions like that, the plane costs you a lot of money. This one's estimated at $550 billion in 2010 dollars, which is kind of old dollars now, probably well over $650, $700 million in today's dollars. And if history is any guide, this plane could well end up costing $1 to $2 billion per airplane.
Would that contract be completed at that rate if it was that many planes for that kind of a cost?
Well, let's look at the history here. The reality is the last couple of times we've gone out of the gate with bomber programs, the B-1 and the B-2, we bought 40, 50 planes fewer of the B-1 than we planned to buy. We planned to buy 130 B-2s because the cost just rose and rose and rose. We bought, in fact, ended up buying 21 of them. I rather suspect that this program is likely to have a similar history. It will grow in cost. It is almost inevitable given 70 years of history in aircraft acquisition. That will mean that the budgets of the future in the Air Force will not accommodate 80 to 100 aircraft, which means they'll buy them more slowly and they'll buy fewer of them. So if we get more than 30 or 40, maybe at the most 50 of these aircraft, I'd be very surprised.
Let me go back to William Hennigan with the LA Times at the Pentagon. Why does the Pentagon estimate the cost in 2010 dollars?
Well, those are the estimates that were first made when the program started under Secretary Gates at the time.
So they didn't update the numbers in order to announce the bid?
Right. So a program like this is got a lot of secrecy attached to it, and the actual terms of the contract are classified. So you have to operate underneath these older estimates, which are done by outside analyzing firms, and that's what we were left with, $550 million.
So, Robert Kleinhans, back to you with the Economic Development Corporation. It sounds like there's a good deal of uncertainty about this, which it would seem to me makes it hard to predict.
There's no doubt about it. The program is stealth in every sense of the word. We're waiting for details to come forth from Northrop Grumman or from the Air Force. Again, we don't know specifically whether the program is going to be located in Palmdale. Keep in mind that Northrop Grumman has other facilities here in Southern California. It's very likely that they're going to do at least some of the work in Southern California, in Los Angeles County, whether they actually do assembly in Palmdale or not. But so much of this is speculative at this point.
So, Gordon Adams, if we have U-2s made in 1955 still flying, and I understand there are B-52s as well still in the Air Force Armada, why do we need new bombers, and who would we bomb?
Well, it's not clear that we do need it. The Air Force has wanted to start this program for some time, and as I said, the budget for it may make it unaffordable at the numbers they plan to buy it. These planes last a very long time, and they last a long time for two reasons. One is because we don't fly them every day all day, and secondly, because we invest considerable money, $1 billion, $2 billion a year, in upgrading and modernizing them. We have 76 B-52s. We've got 70 B-1s. We've got 20 B-2s. In other words, we've got about 165 bomber aircraft that are capable of long-range operations at this point. And some of them started being built way back in the 1960s. So they do last a long time. If this plane is ever built, it will last a long time, too. But it's not clear that the mission requires an additional number of aircraft.
What conceivable mission would?
Well, it's not. We're not likely to be engaging in a bomber warfare with nuclear weapons with Russia. We're very unlikely to be actually sending penetrating long-range bomber aircraft into a potential adversary like China. Even with stealth features, they will simply disappear, which means we're really talking about using bombers in the ways that we have been using them for the last 10 or 15 years. That is, as high altitude, in some cases even lower altitude, what they call air interdiction missions, pattern bombing with sophisticated weapons that, air-launched cruise missiles that can go in and, you know, take out communications nodes and radar sites and things that we've seen in Iraq or in Afghanistan or that we're probably seeing in eastern Syria and western Iraq now against ISIS. In other words, we're operating them against foes who simply don't have the air defense capability to shoot them down anyway.
So ISIS, for example, couldn't take one of these things out.
There's no way ISIS is going to take something. Even a B-52 would be a challenge for ISIS. They simply don't have the surface-to-air capability. There are suggestions that the Syrians might, S-400 missiles they get from Russia, might be capable of taking down a B-52, but it's not even clear they could take down a B-1 or a B-2.
What about stealth technology? Is it important to try to keep up with that, even if you're not going to use it right away?
Yeah, this is a cat and dog kind of game, or Tom and Jerry. Somebody's always chasing the mouse of stealth technology, and somebody's always trying to improve the radar cross fixation so that they can find the aircraft and take it down. You know, none of these aircraft have really had the stealth capabilities that were originally advertised. But as I said, very few potential adversaries have the kinds of air defense capability that could take them down, even if they're relatively visible.
So, William Hennigan, back to you at the Pentagon with the LA Times. Once again, a lot of uncertainties, but you said there's also a lot of secrecy. So some of the questions being raised by Gordon Adams, I take it, aren't really answerable at the moment.
Forward about why they need this aircraft. They say that their bombers are built in the 1960s, like the B-52, the 1970s with the B-1, and the 1980s with the B-2. That these aircraft are just too old to go forward into a 2020 or a 2040 type time frame.
So that's why they need something new.
Well, that's their argument, and they say that they need this 80 to 100 aircraft in order to bridge that gap into the future. Now, it's as Gordon pointed out, it's unlikely to see that 100 mark. I mean, they wanted to build 132 B-2s back in the 80s and ended up with only 21 of them. So actually seeing 100 stealth bombers is doubtful, no doubt.
Robert Kleinenz with the County Economic Development Corporation, in the event that the contract does go forward and it's at the higher level, is there sufficient labor force in Los Angeles now to fill the new jobs that will be available?
Yeah, I think, you know, aerospace continues to be the strong suit of Los Angeles County and the adjacent region. We have the talent pool of engineers, design individuals, business and managerial, as well as the scientists, to be able to take on these jobs. And, of course, the manufacturing. You have to have skilled and certified manufacturing personnel. So we've got the people who can do it. We have the resources in terms of the physical plant, the facilities, and so on. And then we have a very rich set of suppliers that make for a fairly complete ecosystem for aerospace. So this is a good place for this program to set up shop.
If it happens, we will be there.
Yes, indeed.
Robert Kleinenz, again, the Chief Economist for the Los Angeles County Economic Development Corporation. Thanks a lot for being on our program, along with William Hennigan at the LA Times, at the Pentagon, and Gordon Adams, former senior White House budget official for President Clinton, now a columnist at Foreign Policy Magazine. Great to have you all. Many thanks for being on our program.
Thank you.
Thanks, Warren.
Why shouldn't pot shops sign up to pay taxes on Which Way LA?
Subscribe to the Which Way LA podcast at kcrw.com or download the KCRW app, available anywhere podcasts are found and on all mobile devices.
Warren, I'll be back with Which Way LA. The city of Los Angeles is always short of money, but the city council is trying to cut off what sounds like a potential source of revenue. It wants the city attorney to ask the finance office to stop issuing business tax registration certificates to newly established dispensaries of medical marijuana. Eric Shevin is a lawyer in Sherman Oaks. He specializes in marijuana regulations. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
Why is it that the city council wants to take this action?
Well, the problem is that under the local zoning rules that allow for marijuana dispensaries to operate, no new dispensaries can actually legally operate in the city. The rules that allow dispensaries to operate provide that only those that have started since 2007 and have complied with a series of rules for the last 8 years have a right to operate. So it's only those dispensaries that really should be allowed to get these tax certificates and should be required to pay taxes. What you're seeing is the Office of Finance is continuing to issue these tax certificates, which looks like they're giving out licenses when, in fact, they're just tax collection instruments. So it's incredibly confusing to the general public and, you know, to even landlords who are being asked to rent to dispensaries that don't understand that these tax certificates aren't actually permits to operate. So it's just this incredibly confusing landscape where people who have no right to open marijuana dispensaries are led to believe they can by going into the Office of Finance and getting a tax certificate.
What does it take to get a tax certificate?
Well, it doesn't take much, and I'll tell you that this is something that I've been very frustrated with because I represent many people who are being prosecuted for violating the zoning rule called Proposition D, and I went into the Office of Finance myself, and I said, is this where I can get one of those marijuana sales licenses? And sure enough, they said, yes, it is, and all I needed was an address. So I gave them my law office address, and they looked it up and said, are you really going to open a marijuana dispensary at your law firm? And I said, well, no, of course not. I'm just trying to prove a point here that it's just so absurd that you'll give these out even though there's no right to operate. And they said, well, it's not our job to control who gets these tax certificates. These are only tax instruments. So I got one, and I confirmed that it was free and that I wouldn't have to pay anything if I didn't sell any marijuana. And they gave me a document that looks exactly like my business license that I use for my law firm, but it says Medical Marijuana Collective. It's titled City of Los Angeles Tax Registration Certificate. And down at the bottom in, you know, tiny print, it says issued for tax compliance purposes only, not a license, permit, or land use authorization. So the effect of this is the general public can't make heads or tails about what dispensaries are or are not legal. And the city is complicit in this misunderstanding by continuing to give people this sense of legality by getting these tax certificates. And when I got the certificate, one thing that never happened is I was never told that I couldn't open a dispensary. They basically confirmed that I was getting a license because that's what I asked for, and they never told me, oh, by the way, if you open, you're going to be prosecuted because it violates the city zoning rule.
So do people then get these tax certificates and hang them on the wall because they look like business licenses and then open up for business?
I mean, people, yes, are going to the Office of Finance and they're getting these certificates and convincing landlords to rent to them, and they're opening up dispensaries. And you can see it because every street corner basically has a marijuana dispensary, and there's supposed to be only about 100 of them that can legally operate in the city of L.A., and anyone can tell there's many more than that. And I'm actually inundated on a daily basis with people who want to open dispensaries who have no clue whether they can or can't. And they say they've called the city of L.A., and they refuse to get information from the city. They're directed to read the city's website that lists the text of this Proposition D. And quite honestly, I mean, you know, you'd have to be a legal scholar to understand what this ordinance means. And I've read it 100-plus times, and I always find something new about it every time I read it. It's very confusing.
I understand that your business tax registration certificate is hanging on the wall.
Mine is. I mean, it's really just to prove a point. I have my law firm business license, and right below it, I have my medical marijuana collective tax certificate, and they look identical, with the exception being that one is a license and one is not.
Well, who is responsible for clearing up this confusion?
That's a good question. Obviously, the Office of Finance is part of the city of L.A., and the city attorney's office, which is prosecuting people who are operating unlawfully, is part of the city of L.A., and the city council is trying to put an end to the misunderstanding. I mean, they should not be issuing these tax certificates, but at the same time, you know, you go in and get one, and you're on a list, and the city can very, you know, readily look you up and find out, here's somebody who has a dispensary that doesn't have a right to have one, and they can, you know, pick and choose how long they want to collect tax revenue before they prosecute them and shut them down.
Has anybody actually paid revenue, paid taxes with one of these certificates without a business license?
Well, the city of L.A. does not issue business licenses for dispensaries at all. Nobody has a business license in the city of L.A. The ban on dispensaries has been continuing since 2007, but what the new law put into effect was that some shops have immunity from prosecution. So it's really a backwards way to say that everybody's illegal, but some people can argue that they have a defense. So no one has a business license, but if you have this tax certificate, you're required to pay the city of L.A. 6% of your gross sales on an annual basis.
So only the state issues licenses, is that right, business licenses?
Well, recently a new state law was signed that goes into effect next year that issues state licenses for a variety of marijuana activities.
Right.
Up to this point, there are no licenses for anything. But under this new law, you cannot get a state license unless you have a local permit or license. And since the city of L.A. doesn't issue any permits or licenses, as a result of this new law going into effect, every dispensary in the city of L.A. will be illegal under the new law.
Okay, so once again, the city council has asked the city attorney to ask the Office of Finance to stop issuing these certificates, which say down at the very bottom in tiny little print, this is not a license to do a business. We'll see if, in fact, the city attorney does that. In the meantime, Eric Chevin, you have explained the confusion involved, but I don't think anybody could explain it, at least at this point.
It's definitely not cleared up. I mean, at a minimum, L.A. has to revise their zoning rule and agree to issue permits so that those people that have a right to operate know that they have a right to operate, and then they can go one step further and actually obtain a state license. But until that happens, it's just a black hole of misunderstanding.
Eric Chevin, an attorney in Sherman Oaks, thanks a lot for being on our program.
All right, thanks so much.
Remember, you can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, insiders and outsiders on the road to the White House on To the Point.